Carolina.
No one was sweeter than the sweetie when I meet her in the morning.
The morning.
With the morning glory.
The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, I'm Joe Simpson with the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Welcome to Triangle Yesteryear. On this program, you will hear reminiscences of life in earlier times around North Carolina's Triangle area, written by local authors. On today's program, I'll continue reading excerpts from Stories in Stone, Memories from a Bygone Farming Community in North Carolina, an oral history of the William B. Umstead State Park area, by Tom Weber. Continuing with Chapter 2, Rural Customs, Arts, and Trades. Music was as natural a part of community life as farming. Whether church hymns or ballads, they were traditional tunes and lyrics that had been brought over, mainly from the British Isles, to this country with the first settlers. Though there were some variations from one singer to the other, or one family to the other, the basic melody and story within each song remained the same. The songs have been preserved both within families and, to no small degree, by song catchers like Cecil Sharp in the Appalachians and Mercedes Steele, the latter of whose work is cited so often herein. An example follows. My mama and your mama was hanging out clothes. Along came a blackbird and picked off your mama's nose. Chicken in the bread tray picking up dough. Come back, chicken, and pick a little mow. Junebug, Junebug, settin' on the sweet potato vine. Come an old turkey gobbler, slippin' up behind. Pecked that bug right off of that vine. Those were lyrics from a folk song documented by Mercedes Steele around 1935. She wrote in 1936, "Music often made the work go easier as well. Mr. John S. King explained the following song was sung after men finished shucking corn. They would make a chair with their arms and tote around the man the corn belonged to, singing. They would tote the oldest son next, and on such occasions the young John would hide. They called Dad a big time," John said. When questioned about men's work songs in the field, however, Mr. King observed that "de women and chillen done de singin' in de field, but the men people, they'd whoop and holler. Round it up and heap it up, a-boo-ha-hoo, bring around the Jimmy John, a-boo-ha-hoo." A Jimmy John is a glass liquor jar. In late 19th century and early 20th century rural North Carolina, as in other parts of the country, recreation was homegrown. Children invented many of the games they played, or took their cue from activities handed down through the generations. Maggie Smith Goodwin and her brother Vernon Smith recall childhood games from the 1920s and 1930s. "We played hopscotch, jump rope, jacks, horseshoes, and bat the ball," says Maggie. "We played with the few toys we had, like a wagon," says Vernon. "We made baseballs from strings and bats from round wood about 3 feet long. The boys played marbles. These were played by drawing a circle 3 to 6 feet on the smooth ground. Each person placed 3 to 5 marbles in the center of the ring on a mound. We took turns shooting them until all the marbles were out of the circle. Every boy had a bean shooter made from a wooden staff in the shape of a Y with 2 strips of rubber and a piece of leather to hold the stone. They would cut the ends off metal horseshoes, and it would be about a half-inch square, and they would make good jacks rocks. You lay them all down, and you throw the ball upward about 2 feet. You pick up one, and you catch the ball. Then you pick up 2 and catch the ball." Bill Haley says, "About the time the WPA was building those cabins in the park, around 1936, we were getting boards and the nails they dropped off the houses. They'd be bent, but they weren't rusty like the ones we pulled out of fence posts. We'd make fun out of things. We made wagons. We cut black gum trees. That's the toughest ones. We tried to get a perfectly round tree, which was impossible. We'd think it was round till we bored a hole in it with a hand brace and bit. And if we could get an axle, I had one tricycle all my life, and of course I wore that out. But I had that axle left. So we took that and scrounged up another one from somebody's wagon and made these little carts. Just a board down the middle and down each axle. Put a rope on it. We'd pull it up the hill and ride down. That was the fun we had. And fishing, swimming in the old scout camp, Camp Craggy. Mercedes Steely writes, Mrs. Robert Goodwin rewarded her with an account of the game Roosters and Pullets, after Steely presented Goodwin with a bunch of wild violets collected by the wayside. Wild violets were called roosters and pullets. Roosters were those that had patches of dark purple, and pullets were the plain blue ones. One child would hold a rooster, and the other a pullet, and they would hook the heads together and pull to see whether the rooster or the pullet would win, that is, pull the opponent's head off. The particulars of Molly Molly Bright were related to Mercedes Steely by Savannah Brown Rogers and Rebecca Jones. Three players take part. Two stand facing each other, some distance apart. The third stands to one side, about halfway between the two, impersonating a witch. One of the first two asks the player across from him, How far is it from here to Molly Molly Bright? The distance is 80, answers the player addressed. The first player inquires, Can I get there by candlelight? The second player replies, You can if your legs are long and light, but mind out the old blue witch don't catch you on the way. At this point, the first two players try to change places, and the witch tries to catch them. When the witch succeeds in catching one of them, the person caught must change places with the witch, and the game proceeds as before. When I was young, around 1913, we didn't have many things, says Truma Warren Edgerton. We manufactured our fun. My sister Laoma, who was older, milked the cow. She did it when the cow was eating, so it would hold still. My sister Lila and I would run around behind Laoma, teasing her. The cow would turn and look at us. Laoma pointed that milk teat and squirted us in the face. But sometimes she missed. Like ballad singing, storytelling was often a family tradition and provided hours of recreation, particularly before radio and automobiles offered more choices. The following two stories are from The Folk Songs of Ebenezer Community, a master's thesis by Chapel Hill student Mercedes Steely, from 1936. They were told by John S. King. The Woman Cat, a Witch Tale. Every night a man would hear a cat yowling around his room, until finally he decided to kill it. The first night she was messing with him, he threw the pillow at the cat hole and jumped out of bed, but she got out. The next night the same thing happened. Then he carried his brush broom in the house to whoop the cat with. No sooner had the animal come through the cat hole than he threw the broom in the hole and caught the cat. The man put his foot in the cat hole and beat the animal with the brush broom. He kept beating her until she turned into a Negro woman. Finally, the woman promised not to bother him any more, if only he would let her go. Another story of Mr. King's had to do with a man's, quote, taking a hen's egg and hatching it in a minute's time after it was laid. Steely writes that, after hearing this story, John King's much more matter-of-fact brother observed dryly, I wouldn't believe that if I'd have hatched it myself. In addition to storytelling, a good riddle was always a favorite. These riddles are from The Folk Songs of Ebenezer Community by Mercedes Steely. Related by Mr. M. J. Carlton, March 1935. Round as a ring, deep as a cup, all the king's oxen can't pull it up. What is it? A well. These were related by Mrs. Julius Dillard, in April 1935. What goes to the creek and never drinks? A cowbell. House full and yard full. Can't get a spoonful. What is it? Smoke. Round as a biscuit, busy as a bee. Prettiest little thing you ever did see. What is it? Answer, a watch. And then there were true tales for telling and entertaining. Joseph Samuel Grissom, who was born in 1928, recalls Tally Dampier's Talking Crow. Tally had a pet crow, says Joe. He'd broken its beak and taught it to say, "Tally, tally." People came from all around to see that. Hugh Dampier, who was born in 1924, remembers another trick. His Uncle Tally put corn grains under the porch, and the crow clawed up a loose board to reach them. Closely akin to storytelling, superstitions and folk beliefs were woven into daily life. A former community member recalls, "One farmer hung raw meat in trees outside his house to appease evil spirits. Another man used to bury horseshoes in front of the dairy barn for good luck, so the milk would be sweet. Someone else said that it was bad luck to look at the moon through the trees." Mercedes Steely reported the following Ebenezer community tales of superstition. Rebecca Jones said a man had been placed in the moon to punish him for burning a brush pile on Sunday. Rebecca said that when the new moon was flat, it held the water, and the weather would be dry. When the moon was slightly tilted, it was a drippin' moon. The water was spilling, and the weather would be wet. A community resident told of witches' bridles made of silver. He said a black man in the community was ridden by witches. He wouldn't sleep a bit when the witch was riding him up and down Crabtree Creek. It worried him to death. He'd have to plow all next day. The next day, he couldn't hardly take hold of his plow for the bramble briars in his hands.
I remember well the day.
Gatherings for young people and adults were often held in the church, home, and occasionally the company mill. Very early in the 1900s, young people got together for play parties at which country games were held. An example is the Game of Fire. Mercedes Steely documented the game as it was enthusiastically related to her by Savannah Rogers around 1936. The players sit in chairs in a ring, at the center of which stands one of their number, holding a lighted broom straw in his hand. This he passes to another player, who in turn gives it to the person sitting beside him. As the player hands the broom straw to another, he says, "Jack's alive, lives like a bee. If it lives in my hand and dies in yours, your back shall be saddled." The person in whose hand the burning straw goes out must lie face downward upon the floor. The others now hold some object over him, saying, "Heavy, heavy hangs over you." If the player fails to guess what is being held over him, the article in question is placed on his back, and something else is held over him. The process is continued until a correct guess is made. Even chairs may be piled on the hapless player. In 1936, Mercedes Steely wrote, "In response to a question concerning the recreations of her youth, Mrs. Savannah Rogers said, 'Sunday school and preaching and the regular old stump-down dance.'" Agatha King Johnson says, "My father told me about a girl who would plow until dark, go home and eat, wash up a little, then walk across the low grounds up to a house near Al King's and dance until midnight. Then she'd walk home and get up and plow again. My parents didn't let us dance. I didn't go to a dance until I was 20, and then I just watched. The couples were pretty, the way they moved around." John S. King remembers this exuberant dance call. "Log chain hook, Arkansas style, turn yo sweetheart and go hog wild." Parties often centered around a theme. One such was called a candy party. According to Rebecca Jones, writes Mercedes Steely, "The young men would contribute money, and the people at whose house the party was given would buy the candy." Those were the party games. Candy parties dwindled out by the 1930s. And, of course, there was that old standby, the quilting party. Steely writes, "The women and girls were invited to someone's home to quilt and prepare supper. The men were involved to shuck corn. The guests arrived about 1 o'clock. Some of the women quilted bedspreads by inserting cotton between the top and the lining and stitching right through. They had supper around 6, then came music, dancing, and plays. Truma Warren Edgerton remembers that there were community get-togethers at the company mill on Crabtree Creek from around 1917 to 1930. She says, "The mill had a big wheel and a huge dam. People from Durham would come out with rowboats and canoes and fish. Before I was big enough to go down there, I don't know how many times my family went down there on those picnics." The mill had an opening under the front, supported by some posts. You might have to stoop down, and there were big rocks down there. You could get across the water. There used to be all down that thing, there are great big rocks you could climb all over, and the prettiest flowers blooming all up there. Everybody was roaming around. Some people would go down, some people would go across. People just gathered. Then sometimes somebody would bring some music. We used to call them fiddles. Get word out and decide to have a dance. I know I went to one, maybe two. We were living in Durham then, just happened to go down there. The mill really had 3 stories. The dances were on the 2nd floor, because downstairs they had the grinding and all. It wasn't a big place. It was activities here and yonder all along. In my time, most parents didn't let their daughters go out alone with a boy, says Agatha King Johnson. Courting was at home, in the sitting room. It was not like now. Girls weren't allowed to ramble and go out when they got ready. We had little way to travel. Sometimes several couples together would walk track paths, shortcuts through the woods. A lot of the social life was at church. When Silas Dampier was courting Genevieve Woodson, about 1928, Jen insisted that Silas's 5-year-old brother Hugh accompany them on a drive. Silas was frustrated, but relented. He told Hugh, "Okay, but you can't sit in the middle." Trying to impress girls was sometimes comically hazardous. "The first $500 I saved, I bought me a good horse named Scout, and kept it where the Dickinsons had a barn," says Buck Haley, recalling his late 1930s youth. "About my age, there was a pretty blonde girl, Dorothy Dickinson, and she sat on the porch, and I had that buckskin horse. He was tough. I was going to show her how fast I could ride by. Anyway, it was kind of wet, raining. I brought Scout to the top of the hill and opened him wide open. But then Scout turned, and when he turned, he fell. That horse fell on me, and the only thing that saved me was that it was real soft and wet and sloppy there. I just eat that dirt up. And talk about people seeing stars, man. I saw moons when that horse sat on me. It weren't a very big horse, neither, but just hit so hard I see right now like balls of fire it hit." Some of the most exciting family excursions were outside the community. Lila Warren Spain recalls, "We would leave before daybreak to drive to the fair, the biggest event of the year, except Christmas. All the kids would lie down in the wagon bed and cover up with quilts. All the kids rode the hobby horses, the ones that moved up and down, except me. Mama made me sit in the stationary seat, because I was too little to ride the horses. Broke my heart." The state fair was a glorious experience. Serpentina, the snake woman, the fat lady, the world's biggest horse, the world's smallest horse, Minnehaha, the tattooed man, the Hoochie Coochie girls, all the local men and boys who could got jobs at the fair. Lila recalls another pre-1920 childhood event. "I remember going to Raleigh and sitting at the foot of a horse-drawn buggy, and when we got to the paved streets, I was thrilled to death because you could hear the horses' hooves striking the pavement." Before long, automobiles ruled the roads. "I was terrified the first time I rode in a car," says Genevieve Woodson Chapel. "There were no horses in front of me. I said, 'How do you make it turn?'" Edith Dickinson Highsmith tells about the first time she drove an automobile. A neighbor let 14-year-old Edith drive his new car. Edith hopped in and headed up the hill out of sight before she realized she didn't know how to put the car in reverse. She drove all the way up Old Middle Hillsborough Road from her house to Adams Crossroads, several miles away, before she could find a place wide enough to circle back. Hugh Dampier remembers a design flaw in the Ford Model T. The gas tank was placed so that fuel couldn't reach the engine when you drove forward up a steep hill. So Hugh's father had to drive up the old mill road in reverse. There were some folks who thought very little of the newfangled contraptions. Delaney King didn't like cars, Agatha King Johnson says. She never rode in one, and said that after she died, she didn't want her body moved in a truck or hearse. So her coffin was carried by hand to the edge of a field near her home and buried there, rather than being driven to her family's plot. By the late 1930s, young people were pulling away from the old-time ways. Mercedes Steele writes, "A word should be said, by way of contrast, between the present-day recreations," that's 1936, "of Ebenezer youth and those enjoyed 35 or more years ago." Miss Genevieve Woodson could speak authoritatively on this subject, as her work as Ebenezer schoolteacher had placed her in close touch with the young people of that community. She had, for example, undertaken to foster Boy Scout and Campfire Girl activities. The Campfire Girls gave plays in the schoolhouse under her direction, later taking them to Raleigh as well. With the profits that accrued from such performances, the girls were enabled to buy uniforms and playground equipment. "Young people," says Miss Woodson, "have lost interest in folk songs and folk dances. They do have square dances occasionally, but they have ceased to play the play party games. They hold sings in the church and in different homes, at which they sing hymns. Sometimes they go to each other's homes to make some music, taking guitars, banjos, and fiddles, and sing folk songs. They hold modern contests and play modern games such as puzzles, question-and-answer contests, rook, setback, etc." Mercedes writes, "The few young people with whom I myself have spoken took very little interest, for the most part, in either folk songs or play party games." By 1934, times were indeed changing, and the biggest change of all was about to come, the creation of a park. In the year 2000, the properties of Verna King Sorrell, who was born in 1911, and her sister, Agatha King Johnson, on Westgate Road, were islands of old-time farm life amid an ocean of new housing developments. Verena and Agatha have spent much of their lives here. As children, they attended Ebenezer School and Ebenezer Church, just outside today's park boundaries. Giant oaks shade barns that overlook pods of white condominiums on Verena's former cropland. The tobacco-curing barn, the corn-crib building, and the big barn with the hayloft and mule stalls are no longer used, but they weather handsomely. A crunchy carpet of decayed acorns covers the area between the barns and Verena's house. Here, a modern visitor can easily imagine what an old-time family farm in the park area must have looked like. Agatha's place, a couple of 100 feet south on Westgate Road, is a tin-roofed bungalow with a large garden that Agatha and her son Alton cultivate. Here and there on Agatha's plot are heavy, rusting farm implements, some serviceable, some not, all reminders of a lifetime working the land. Farmers used lots of substantial metal implements, not many of which you would find at the corner hardware store today. An example is the bell shown on page 57 of this book, which Agatha King Johnson's grandmother used to alert field workers when meals were ready. Robert Warren recalls how the ring of such a bell carried across the fields. Hitching up a mule. Agatha King Johnson describes how a plow is attached to a mule. The mule wore a collar with metal rings on each side. From each ring, a chain or trace ran behind the mule and attached to rings on each end of a single tree, a bar which held the chains away from the mule and was attached to the plow. Concern for an old blind mule. "One time Al King's folks were planting corn in March," says Agatha King Johnson. "They had an old blind mule that could plow just as good as any other. Come up a hailstorm, and this old colored woman grabbed a feed box and put it over the mule's head. Grandpa Al said, 'What are you doing?' She said, 'I'm trying to keep the hail from popping his eyes out.' The mule was already blind, but she was protecting it." Agatha says her brother Millard was plowing with a tractor once, and his thoughts were wandering as he reached the end of a row. With a start, he yelled, "Whoa!" as if the tractor were a mule, but he kept going straight into the bushes. Growing tobacco. Although tobacco was not a primary crop for most Stories in Stone community farmers, the gold leaf did figure in local economics. Farming tobacco was hard work, Agatha King Johnson remembers of the 1930s. We did everything with mules and human power. We didn't have tractors. You start early in the spring by making a plant bed of really rich soil, maybe on the edge of a field or somewhere, and plant your tobacco seeds there. The men edged a bed with logs and put cloth over to protect the seedlings from frost. The fields were fertilized and plowed. Then you transplanted those plants from the bed to the fields when the tobacco was about a hand high. Before you primed, or pulled the leaves off, the mature tobacco, you'd top, or cut the seed pod off, the plant, so the leaves would ripen, or turn yellow. If you wanted to save seeds to plant in the spring, you'd leave the top on a plant here and there in the field to let the seeds dry. You didn't prime all the leaves on a plant at once. You started at the bottom of the stem as the leaves turned yellow. You had to go through the fields several times over 2 or 3 weeks, priming leaves from the plant's bottom to the top. A mule pulled a drag, or tobacco sled, between the rows. The drag was narrow, so it didn't knock down the stems, and was several feet long. Agatha says a torn-open feed bag was tacked onto the drag to hold the primed leaves. When the drag was full, the mule pulled it to a tobacco barn where the leaves were dumped on a table. Looping tobacco, or tying leaves to a tobacco stick to be hung in a curing barn, took 2 people. A handler made bundles of 2 or 3 leaves and handed them to the looper. The looper placed a tobacco stick about 3 feet long in a looping horse, a device for holding the stick. Using the string, the looper tied leaf bundles hanging from the wide bottom ends of the leaves on alternate sides of the stick, leaving a little space for air between each bundle. When a group of looped bundles reached the end of the stick, the looper tied off or knotted the string. The fully looped tobacco stick was then hung in the curing barn. The heat of burning oak wood was transferred from a furnace outside the barn through metal pipes inside, curing the tobacco. They kept the fire going for days, depending on the amount of tobacco in the barn. Somebody had to check the fire 2 or 3 times a night, Agatha says. We've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Yesteryear. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Joe Simpson, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Following the broadcast, this episode is readily available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. Nothing could be finer than to be in Carolina in the morning.